That. He told you that I'm the director of the Anglican Multi-Ethnic Network, also known as Amen. You get Anglican Multi-Ethnic Network. There we go. And so you can find us. There's a Facebook page, and our website is in the process of being relaunched. We'll be having a blog that begins soon and other resources. And so the vision of the Anglican Multi-Ethnic Network is to help local Anglican churches better reflect the universal saving power of the gospel by establishing new multi-ethnic churches in dioceses that don't have one, and helping monocultural churches become multicultural churches. That's one of the things that I do. The other thing that I do that isn't distinctly Anglican, but I do it with a wider circle of my friends, is this thing called the Call and Response Conference. And that'll be held this year in Rochester, New York. And it's on the past, present, and future of Black Christians in America. And so if you have African American friends, and we'll get to this later, or if you want to come, I really encourage you to sign up and come to that conference. We have a great lineup of speakers there, and we would love to have you. Now, I'm warning you all, this is not an Anglican event, so there'll be no morning prayer. There'll be no colics, and there'll be a lot of Black people around. Okay. So just be prepared. It's not an exaggeration. And by the way, after I heard that talk yesterday, I felt really bad about the quality of my PowerPoint. So the art is going to be completely absent, and there's going to be some text. But I really was worried that, because I'm going to give you guys a lot of statistics, that this might go over your head really quickly. The last thing I'll say to you, actually, before I give this, is kind of a warning. I know that a lot of you all are tweeting about this conference, but be careful about like how you tweet some of these quotes, because it might sound weird. Because I'm going to say stuff about like single parenthood in the Black community, and if you have never tweeted anything about Black people and you start tweeting out single parent statistics, it'll sound a little racist. Okay? So make sure that you're contextually sensitive on how you use my quotes. Otherwise, the Black people who I know are going to say, "What did you do, Esau?" Okay? I don't want Black Twitter coming for me. So with those caveats being in place, I'll go ahead and get started. It's not an exaggeration to say that I've waited over a decade to have this wider conversation about multi-ethnicity in our province. But before I begin, I feel like I want to tell you a story about the first time that I met an Anglican bishop, or someone who would become an Anglican bishop. This was back in 2004 or 2005, when John Guernsey, who's now the Bishop of the Diocese of the Mid-Atlantic, came to visit Bill Murdoch's church, who's currently the Bishop of the Diocese of New England. And at the time, I was a lowly seminarian and a youth minister working for Bill, and these two men were leaders. They, at the time, were these things called deans, and what was then called the Anglican Communion Network. Does anybody remember those days? The network days. That would eventually become the Common Cause Partnership that would eventually become what we now know as the Anglican Church in North America. I've been tasked to do what they often do with seminarians, which is drive the important person from out of town around and listen to him kind of give us his wisdom. But I was busy because seminary takes a lot of time. And so I found myself saying I actually can't drive Dean Guernsey, who would become Bishop Guernsey, around, and so only had a few minutes, because the way that this works is that you trade your Saturday of driving this person around and getting their food to be able to ask them questions, right? You get your chance to trade. You know, you guys seen this? And so I didn't have the day to give, so I just said, I'm going to go up to him, and I'm going to shoot my shot. I'm going to give him the questions that I want to ask. And I said to him, I said, you seem like a pretty big deal and what's going to become this Anglican thing. And so whenever you guys start the new province, can you make sure that it's poorer and more diverse? It's really interesting as a sidebar that people are paying attention to Anglicanism now, especially this morning with the royal wedding. And on one level, I'm happy about it. But on the other hand, I was like, that's so Anglican, right? We need literally royalty and pomp and circumstances and hundreds of thousands of dollars to kind of put our best face forward. That's a sign of the week. I saw someone, God bless them, I saw someone saying, if you want to come to church, you know, there's more preaching like that available. I was like, waiting for a royal wedding as a window into evangelism is the epitome of Anglican privilege. But anyways, I'll just move on. And I loved it. I loved it. You know, it was great. But the whole point, though, I said, can you make a poem more diverse? And I remember, I can't help but call him Bishop Guernsey, but this is non-chronological. He said, do you have a card? And I go, I'm a seminarian. No, I don't have a card. But I know there have been many conversations about multi-ethnicity that have taken place in the intervening years. And I'm very glad to be, that now the province, it's on some sense, it's great because they took all our money, right? So we're poor. So that part's taken care of. And now we're going to look at what it looks like to become more diverse. I'm going to focus our time with my story, because my story as an African-American in Anglicanism in some sense gives will serve as a framing reference for the African-American experience more generally. I'm going to divide my talk into two parts. The first part, I'm going to talk about my life from 0 to 18, and then I'm going to talk about my life from 18 to 36. And those two segments of time are actually going to be windows into different experiences of Black culture. The first part is going to cover, is going to deal with, just to kind of help you guys understand what I'm talking about 21% of African Americans will go on and get college degrees. And we're going to talk about their experiences in the second half, because they actually go to college. The first half, between 0 to 18, is the 70% or 70 whatever, what's that left over? 79% of African Americans who don't. So, 60% of the African American population lives in the South. So, my childhood in Alabama is somewhat representative. What we'll be missing, though, in my presentation is the experiences of the large percentage of African Americans who live in major cities. And so if you're wondering where Black people are, so you're saying, why there are no Black people in my neighborhood? Why is that? It's because 60% of us live in the South, and if we're not in the South, we're all in major cities. Houston, Texas, New York, Chicago, L.A. So, for example, 2.3 million African Americans live in New York City alone. So one of the implications of this is, if you plant churches where there are no Black people, you know what's going to happen? Ah, there we go. There we go. It's like, what do we do? Stop planting churches in the suburbs. Anyways, along with 67% of my Black contemporaries, I was raised in poverty by a single mother. So as 67% of all African Americans are raised in single parent homes, and we know that the average income of a single parent home is $32,000. So the odds are that an African American, statistically, right, are going to be poor, Black, and Southern, at least at some point in their life. Not all, but a significant number of them. But to be honest, even though I quote these statistics, I always hated them. Statistics were often weapons wielded against a young Black child's imagination, proclaiming that I would not be a doctor or a lawyer or an astronaut, only an athlete, a rapper, or a criminal. When I was a kid, Kanye West, who's kind of run into a rough patch recently, he was one of my favorite rappers, and he had this the chorus of one of his songs where I wasn't supposed to make it past 25, but joke's on you, I'm still alive. Right? That was like a hit song. Y'all didn't sing that? Okay, we'll move on. Right. And so the media portrayals of African Americans on television and on the radio told me that I was more likely to end up in jail than in the college degree. But me and Kanye showed y'all. But I was not a collection of tropes, right? Young, Black, Southern, and raised by a single mom. I'm Esau McCauley. My mother is Lori McCauley. I say this because the information about the African-American experience must be kept in tension with the real people who experience these things. Blacks are not simply acted upon. We are actors. And like any community, we need Jesus. But what we do not need is human saviors who read these statistics and say, I'm going to come in with my wisdom and education and expertise and save the black community. If the ACNA is to reach African Americans, we cannot come in with the attitude that we are somehow better than the communities that we hope to serve. Now back to my mother. Lori worked long hours at Chrysler to clothe and feed us, so she was a factory worker, until she got sick with a brain tumor that would leave her able to function but unable to work. And so we went on government assistance, right? And even bigger trope, how much more statistic can I get, right? And over time, we moved into poorer and poorer neighborhoods, and our houses got smaller and smaller. And so now I'm 16 or 17 years old, on government assistance, and one of four children being raised by a single mother. I'm doomed, right? And the payoff of this entire narrative, my own story, is this. If I were coming up today, if young Esau Macaulay existed and he was 16 or 17 years old, and I wanted to attend an Anglican church, would there be one near me? Would there be one in my neighborhood, in my city, in my community? Were I to encounter an Anglican? People like me are largely off the Anglican radar. When I went to college, I went to an Episcopal university, and I didn't even know what an Episcopalian was. Never met one. I'll tell you, here's a free story time. So I attend the Episcopal church. Don't ask me like how I fell in love with the leader, just another story. And I come back to my hometown, and I said, I want to go to an Episcopal church during summer vacation. And so there isn't one on my side of town. There's one on the other side of town, literally called Whitesburg. So I leave my neighborhood and drive to Whitesburg, and I attend this Episcopal church. This is before there was an ACNA. I attend this Episcopal church, and I sit in a pew, and like, this isn't like a big church, and there was plenty of people there in the pew. No one sat beside me. And during the piece, I was just without the peace of the Lord. And because I'm a jerk or I'm difficult, I decided if they're going to be mean to me, I'm going to stay around. And so I sat there. I went to coffee hour, and I just sat right by the coffee, drinking coffee, eating snacks, and made them, each person walk past me and not speak to me. But anyways, God bless the Episcopal Church. The point of that is, to be honest, it's not so much that African Americans, especially those of us who are at this point undereducated or the black lower class, it's not so much that we've rejected Anglicanism, it's that Anglicanism is largely absent from our experiences. And if we plan on this, I don't know if you guys know this, we have a mission statement in ACNA, reaching North America with the transforming love of Christ. It's our stated mission. If we have to do that, then we need to have an actual plan for reaching North America. We functionally, and I love us, we functionally actually should say reaching white North America with the transforming love of Christ. Because we have no plan to reach into inner city communities and actually evangelize the places where these things are necessary. And I'm not talking about outreach to my neighborhood as if to go in and simply give services. I'm talking about coming into the community, becoming a part of the community, serving it, evangelizing it, and integrating those people into our communities. I'm going to skip ahead, but I'll come back to this later. We still have almost a 90s ministry of racial reconciliation in the ACNA, where our model is, let's make friends with black people, and then they go back to their black corner, and we go back to our white corner. Versus the fact that the minorities who are actually in our congregations are desperately looking for community. We know how to make black friends, right? We don't need a ministry that does that. We need actually evangelism that incorporates other people into Anglican communities. I hope then that we get to the point where we can no longer say the words reaching North America with the transforming love of Christ without thinking about people of color. So it seems then that the 16 to 18 year old version of me would have been left to my own devices. But if I managed to make it to university or seminary, Anglicans would be happy to have me. I'm going to, once again, this is a trust tree, right? I can be honest. I've spoken at numerous ACNA churches and conferences. And every time I go somewhere at an Anglican conference, a bishop or a rector will come up to me and say, Esau, where do you work? So God said, well, you know, we have a job available for you. Will you please come and work in our diocese? Or you please come and take a job at our church? And it's almost like if we survive the Hunger Games, then the Anglicans are happy to steal us. What I want to say is that there are thousands of young African Americans who are just like I was when I was 16 and 17 and 18 years old. And if we invested in them, we'd eventually have a generation of clergy. And it's so funny because I don't know why, maybe because Kanye went crazy. His lyrics are on my brain. But he had this other song that he used to listen to, that I used to listen to when I was a kid. And he said that they say to me that I shouldn't feel myself. Feel myself is black language of being arrogant. And then he said, you know, but where were you when I couldn't feed myself? He's like, you criticized my black arrogance, but like when I was hungry, you weren't around. And so part of me wants to say, well, I'm glad y'all want to hire me now, but where were you when I was 17 or 18 years old? But in reality, I was not left without a witness. My mother told me about Jesus and took me to church every Sunday, even when I didn't want to be there. I was from the black church, and so we would start church at 10 o'clock, and it would be lucky if we ended by 1:30. And I'm going to confess some sins for you. I got a bishop and plenty of priests here. Two bishops. This is going to be double sanctification. So they'd end the church service, and you know, in the Baptist church, they'd open the doors to the church for people to get saved, right? You guys see, you seeing this? And I'm going to be honest. I was praying, please, nobody get saved, because I want to get to the game, the 1 o'clock start game. And when five or six people got saved, it's like, oh gosh, now they're going to give a testimony, and there's halftime, right? I remember once, so many people were getting saved. The pastor stood up and said, okay. He said to deacons, you guys go out and you just get some food because we didn't get this thing catered. We're going to be here to 3 o'clock. And I was like, oh, it's over. And we did. 30 people became Christian. We had to have food for 1,000 people, testimony after testimony after testimony. And my 12-year-old soul was severely embittered. but my experience of high-level church attendance aren't unique. This is the next one. More than half of African Americans, that's 53% of us, report attending religious services at least once a week. And more than 3 in 4, 76% say they pray at least daily. And 9 in 10 indicate that they're absolutely certain that God exists. Tupac's famous line was, "Only God can judge me." I used to say, "But he will." So you're not likely then to encounter many African Americans who are unfamiliar with the basic contours of the Christian faith, although they may be de-churched. What you will see is that in general, there's a much stronger activist social justice streak because in many ways, our faith is tied to our survival. We didn't have the luxury to argue endlessly the finer points of justification. We were trying to figure out, how did this Christian faith help me get through my day? This is funny because I'm an N.T. Wright scholar who like doesn't care about justification. It's like, why? Because I'm black. And it's not our stuff, right? Like, God saves us. If we believe, it'll be fine. I know. I just made some my super reformed people mad. I'm with the 39 articles. Don't cut for me later, okay? At least most of them. All right. In other words, the ACNA efforts towards discipleship will not be conversion of the completely uninitiated, but reconnection and mentoring and discipleship. And our attempts at reaching African Americans will ring hollow if this is not concerned with the real issues facing African Americans and the poor. So concerns about black bodies lying in the streets due to police violence is evangelism. It is evangelism. And our tradition's lack of awareness on this front shows our disconnect. We are afraid. Can I speak about the fear for a second? See, okay. So we are consistently doing this dance in the ACNA, and I can see it on how we read and talk and speak and act publicly. We realize if we say too much, our political right is going to get really, really upset with us. But black people know that too. And you're making the decision of saying it's more important to appease this segment of the population than it is to reach people of color. I'm not saying that we need to become ideologues, but if you're afraid to speak plainly about the issues of concern to African Americans, then we know. And our public posture, like, it's completely evident how afraid we are as a denomination. So if we get nothing from at least this part of my talk, I want to say turn our attention to this community. This 79% of African Americans who never enter universities, who are largely in the South and who are in major cities, who are part of the underclass. We need to really turn our concern there. I'll tell you one more story, and this one is also free. On the morning I was getting ready to leave for college, I sat around with my family and I was eating a bowl of cereal. My car was packed up and I was ready to go to SWANE, the University of the South, an event that would actually change my life. I had to survive my neighborhood and I had won. And I was watching the news, which we never do, but I was watching the news with my family. And there was a news story that morning of a classmate who I had just seen a few weeks earlier. I'll call him, well, his name was Jesse. And we conversed a little bit, and I found out that Jesse was going to Tennessee State, which is not very far from SWANE. And the night before he was getting ready to leave for college, we were going to college on the same day, he went to visit his girlfriend to say goodbye, and some people pulled up and asked him for the rims on his car, and he hesitated for a second, and they shot him down in front of his girlfriend. And I was looking at this story. It was August 14th, 1998, I remember. And I promised myself, and I realized that, like, I wasn't going to college strictly for me. I was going to college for all of the people in my community who would never go. And I promised that if I ever got an education and never had an opportunity to make a difference, I'll make sure the people didn't forget about their witness and their sacrifice. And so my goal is to share my sadness and passion to you so that it might infect you and that you will be unrelenting advocates for those who suffer. In John's letter, 1 John, he says he writes to his congregation to make his joy complete. John knew who Jesus was. He had met him, seen him, touched him, and talked to him. But he said there was something incomplete about his joy, and so that congregation shared that same experience. And my joy is incomplete until the people of color in this country all have transforming encounters with the gospel of Jesus Christ and opportunities to transform their lives. And my job is to make the ACNA's joy, in that sense, incomplete. So the original version of my talk actually did not begin with any of this stuff. I was initially going to begin with what happens from the ages of 18 to 26. But that only accounts for 21% of Anglicanisms. I'm sorry, 21% of African Americans who go to university. It left out so much of, like, the black experience that I felt like it was important to give you guys the experience of the 79%. Now, in some sense, you could say the Anglican failure of the 79% is partially understandable because we're not even there. What we're going to talk about now is this 21% of African Americans who go to college, and our failure here is almost, and I love us, but it's almost unconscionable. So, purpose of the first half of the talk is to give you insight into the 79% of African Americans who are largely off our windows, and also to give you a picture of what African Americans who arrive on college campuses may have experienced. Now, I'm talking about college campuses and college-educated people as being a primary place of Anglican evangelism, because for good or bad, we're a little bit snobby too, right? This is us, right? We're the educated denomination. A significant number of us are college college degree, master's degrees, doctoral degrees. So this is a reality that a significant portion of Anglicanism is in college. And so what I wanted to do is also give you some picture of what some, not all African Americans are like, what they would have experienced in their background when they arrived on college, and also give you some insight into what's happening in amongst black educated people. So my arrival on campus at the University of the South in 1998 meant that I left my all-black neighborhood and my all-black church for something totally different. My sister before me had gone to Tuskegee, a historically black college. Little did I know that my decision to go to a white school instead of a black school was a part of a trend. In 1976 and 1977, 35% of all African-American bachelor's degrees were awarded by HBCUs. That's historically black colleges and universities. That was in 1976 and 1977. By 2005, that number had dwindled all the way down to 9%. Now, if I was in a black setting, we talk about what's actually going on with HBCUs and ways to revive them and whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm speaking to you about a fact. Not making a comment on it, speaking to you about a trend. That means that 91% of all African Americans who receive their degrees will do so in a place where they are a distinct minority. That means that basically the entire black middle class is sitting on college campuses, and we are still conceiving a multi-ethnic ministry as poverty work. Right? You think we want to reach the black people? Well, let's leave our college campus and go to this poor neighborhood and find black people when the entire black middle class was like in class with you. There's some implicit racism going on there, but we'll put that to the side. In many cases, when they come to these campuses, there will be no black church in the area. I went to college at Swanee, no black churches. Nor will there be a black ministry on campus. So let me explain what I'm saying. Is that means that when African Americans arrive on campus, their religious experience is going to change. So once again, more stats. 59% of all African Americans attend black churches. So that's 59% of us. 15% attend evangelical churches. 5% are Catholic, and 4% attend white mainline churches. That means that the vast majority of the 91% will arrive on campus with no campus ministry that fits their experience. There'll be the Black Student Union, which is largely secular. There will be mainline groups, and then there'll be the evangelicals. So now our student who arrives on college campuses is faced with a choice that our white students did not have to make. Which spiritual community will fit me, given that what I had in the past is not an option? And for a long time, socially and culturally, evangelicalism was neither concerned nor equipped to minister to African Americans. Can you go to the next one about the other statistics? Can you go to the next slide? So, now these are recent stats. This is not taking into account these views in the 80s and the 90s. This is today. So this is the black evangelical divide. Why don't black people come into evangelical parachurch ministries when they come on campus? So an incident happens in their community and they come to their evangelical small group. What are they likely to hear? 68% of the evangelicals will say that the police problem is largely a figment of the African-American population, while only 25% of African-Americans are going to believe that. 66% of evangelicals are going to say that that the police treat different racial groups fairly, while only 23% of blacks will think this. Only 36% of evangelicals believe that racism against African Americans is a major problem, while 88% of African Americans believe it is. And so you have a racial incident on campus, you come to your Christian group, and you say, this is the problem, and most of the people in the room are going to think that you are wrong. Or then they're going to explain that it's the exception to the rule. The question is, if you have such a conversation that is, and these are actually, this is an improvement. This is an improvement over what the statistics were in the 80s and the 90s. This is the better, this is the good version. So it's 19, it's, I tell people this, like there's this huge uproar about the future of African Americans in evangelicalism in light of the most recent election. But there was no uproar in the previous elections when a Republican won, right? But it's the fact that there's a significant number of African Americans within evangelicalism who thought that they're going to experience something different. There's actually enough of us to be mad, and now we pay it. Now evangelicals notice. And I say this to my Anglican friends. If there was a black exodus from Anglicanism, I'm not sure that we would notice. Because there's not enough of us to make a stink. Like where did Esau and Cameron go? Anyways. That means that the decision that was usually made, especially through the 80s and the 90s, was to either go and hang out in the black student union and kind of ignore religiosity and make it back into your community at the end of your 4 years, or adopt the more progressive theology of the mainline tradition, because at least there you found some cultural coherence. Right, at least when you went to the Protestant chaplain, he didn't believe anything, right? But he felt your pain about racial injustice. So, for example, every single black person that I knew on campus at Suwannee was a Christian, except for one who was a devout Muslim. And none of us attended a single event offered by the evangelical group on campus until I alone joined the Baptist Student Union in my senior year. What does this mean? What does this mean for us? Especially those of us who come, have a background in the Episcopal Church, which is a large portion of our House of Bishops, I think. I don't know if that's still the case. It means that the vast majority of African-American Episcopalians that they met will either have been lifelong Episcopalians who were raised in progressive settings, or they will be African-Americans who joined the Episcopal Church in college or seminary. I need to state this clearly. There was never an evangelicals on the Canterbury Trail moment for African Americans because there were so few black evangelicals in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when this evangelical revivalist happened in the Episcopal Church. There was no path from a conservative Episcopal Church to Wheaton, to Trinity, or to Gordon-Conwell. It did not exist. So consider for a moment what that would have involved in the 80s and the 90s. To move from the black church tradition to the evangelical tradition. And once in the evangelical tradition, a second shift into Anglicanism. For most white evangelicals who become Anglican, it's a one-step shift. You're raised in a Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, whatever that is, you get burned out on it because it's a little too fundamentalist, and you become Anglican. It's one move. For African Americans, it's a double move. And oftentimes that was the cultural price too high. It also means that the majority of the African Americans who were in the Episcopal Church belonged to a slice of the 4%, that's the 4% of blacks in mainline tradition, not the 75% of African Americans who are in black churches or evangelical churches. So I know because I looked for black traditionalists in the Episcopal Church when I was there and I was unable to locate them, and I looked for them in the ACNA and I've been largely unable to locate them. Therefore, the ACNA's corporate experience of black religiosity is distorted. We've never experienced it. Most of our older or longer serving Anglican clergy experienced a form of black religiosity where justice, multi-ethnicity, and diversity were linked to theological revisionism, because their experience was with blacks in the mainline tradition, which is only 4% of the African-American black African-American religious community, not the 75% of blacks who were either in the black church or in evangelical churches. So I can understand in part why the ACNA is really afraid of issues like justice, multi-ethnicity, and diversity, because they're afraid it's going to turn them liberal. But that association, while true to their experience, is empirically false. You can go and look up the AME Confession, the African American Methodist Episcopal Church. Go look up their statement of beliefs. Go look up the Church of God in Christ statement of beliefs. You will find the doctrines of inerrancy, inspiration. You will find basically a modified version of the 39 articles which the Methodists have, which is brought straight into the AME. Those churches have public witnesses for justice are not completely theologically orthodox and are the vast majority of African-American religious people in this country. But we're, once again, we are fighting this shadow battle against black liberalism that has never been the dominant voice in the black community. And it's also, it's empirically false, but it's also theologically problematic, right? This idea that, like, being biblical, that trying to pursue the vision of Revelation 7:9 and somehow going to ruin our theology is problematic, right? It's almost like you have to excise the prophets. It's a form of Marcionism, where the Old Testament prophetic tradition is excised from the Bible. So, while there was no path into the Anglican tradition, there was a general growth during this time, the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, in the black evangelical community. I talked about the fact that that 69% of African Americans who are in church on Sunday are in a black church. The second largest group is evangelicals. Isn't that crazy? So if you're looking for a black person and not in a black church, the place that you're most likely to find them, despite what the media tells you, is in an evangelical church. The mainline church, who thinks they're in charge of multi-ethnicity and diversity, only has 4%. It's almost like black people did not buy what they were selling. We've had time, we've decided that's not what we want. But during this time, during the 90s and the 2000s, the Southern Baptist Convention, the Christian Reformed Church, the Evangelical Covenant Church, the Evangelical Free Church, the Promise Keepers, and InterVarsity all had devoted initiatives related to multi-ethnicity. And you guys may have seen some of these things on Twitter and on the internet and say they did a very bad job, but they were trying, right? Here's an example. From 1998 to 2007, there's a shift from 6% of megachurches qualifying as multi-ethnic to 25. One in four megachurches in the United States now qualifies as multi-ethnic. That's a tremendous shift from when I entered college up through 2007. And 2007 is an intentional point, because while we're in the midst of our denominational wars, in forming a new denomination, we missed an entire generation of African Americans who created space and gained a voice within evangelical culture. And it is that exact group of people who are at the center of the entire media narrative about the black exodus from evangelicalism. So from the 80s and through the 90s up until the early 2000s, at great cost, many African Americans push for multi-ethnicity. The population of African Americans and people of color grows in the evangelical church, reaching something of a crescendo until the election of 2016. We actually don't know what the future holds after that. So this was particularly true if you want to look at some of the shifts in evangelicalism. I know this is a more positive spin than used to, but I think that what's actually happening with blacks in evangelicalism is not nearly as bleak as I think that it is. If you guys remember what many African Americans remember of something of the bloody summer of 2015, where it felt like every day there was another incident with the police and African Americans. We had protests. Imagine this. We had protests and acts of solidarity at Wheaton College. Wheaton. I mean, you can't get more white evangelical than Wheaton. I think if you cut evangelicalism, it bleeds like orange. Anyways. Right. Yeah, we had acts of solidarity at the heart of Wheaton. We had African Americans and white people within evangelicalism address the issue. And so once again, I'm going to speak about the great failure of evangelical Anglicanism is that we're like the last generation of people who are still fighting this shadow battle against black liberalism. And that inability to get over that deludes our witness. And so I'm contending then that a shift is occurring within evangelicalism despite the last election, and that we are at least 20 years behind that curve, and evangelicalism itself has a long way to go. Our model of racial reconciliation, multi-ethnicity, I love the ACNA, but I sometimes sit and I get these emails and these messages about our plans, and I want to say, nope, Promise Keepers did that 20 years ago. Nope, InterVarsity tried that. That didn't work. I was like, oh, yeah, we tried that model. It doesn't work. So we're in the process now of the early stages of failure. And we actually have this opportunity to learn and skip beyond all of these things and actually get to the hard work. Because what evangelicalism is learning in the last year and a half to 2 years, it's one thing to say we will share some power, but fundamentally ignore the concerns of people of color, and that works during peacetime. But when a real moral crisis is posed, and the voices of African Americans aren't listened to, then you get what's happening now. And what I'm really worried about is that Anglicanism is going to potentially follow this model. We're going to recognize our dearth of minority participation. We're going to make cosmetic fixes, grow enough African Americans to get really frustrated with us, and we're going to experience an exodus. So what I want to say is, don't recognize that evangelicalism is ahead of us, these other denominations, but don't follow that path, because we know exactly where it leads. It leads where we are in 2016 and 17 and 18. But my belief then is that the question is not really whether or not God is concerned with the evangelization of African Americans or with the existence of multi-ethnic churches. I'll say this, and I'll cut out some of this middle part. So our children are changing, right? They are in a place where they, even like I said, most African Americans who are going to university are going to places where they are used to being a part of a multicultural setting. We're not going, for the most part, to HBCUs. Most of your youth are going to high schools and colleges that are diverse. That means that not only is the lack of diversity in the ACNA a crisis for reaching black people, it's going to be a crisis for reaching white youth. The example that I use, that I like to use, is to say that, like, Taylor Swift, you guys remember Taylor? Taylor Swift, when 10 years ago or 5 years ago, was the most culturally and stereotypically white person that you could find. She did country music, right? And that might have scared you. She is. Taylor's white. It's okay. You can laugh at that. Okay. And Kendrick Lamar is probably one of the most Afrocentric rappers that you can potentially find. And last year, or 2 years ago, her last album, there was a Taylor Swift song with Kendrick Lamar. And I thought, country music Taylor would have never seen that coming 7 to 10 years ago. And what does it mean for our youth? Well, they're used to seeing these things mashed up together in popular culture, but they're not seeing these things in the church. So I think that not all. I think there'll always be a portion of American culture that wants monocultural, safe for friends and family, K-love Christianity will exist. It's an increasingly shrinking portion of the pie, but I think it'll exist for the foreseeable future, especially in the more religious South. But if you're on the coast or you're in secular places, you're just not going to be able to create and sustain monocultural churches. I think that eventually there are going to be three questions that oppose the churches. One, I think theological orthodoxy is going to matter, because when you lose the cultural supports of being Christian, the fact that you believe this stuff really matters. When there's no cultural benefit to believing in Jesus, you want a community of people who takes this Jesus stuff seriously. So the question of theological orthodoxy will remain. The second is, what is your concern for the poor and the marginalized? This is the value of social justice in our communities. Three, this is going to be the question of multi-ethnicity. Are you diverse? And young families are going to be asking this question over and over again. I have more white families come to me worried about where they're going to send their kid to elementary school because of diversity than black families. Black families, for the most part, are saying, can I get my kid out of a bad school? And if it has to be all white to get into better education, that's fine. But even young white families are largely concerned with having their kids having a multicultural experience. So you're going to get this question in your congregations. And these are good, actually, biblical questions. And so what I want to say is the ACNA going to join in what God is already doing? And we do not need to change our mission statement to do this. we need to fully embrace our call to reach all of North America with the transforming love of Christ. So, review. I've given you a picture of two communities. 0 to 18, the first half of my life, I mentioned kind of the black underclass or the lower class, the people who are largely off our radar, for whom it's going to take genuine missionary work embedded in those communities. And then in the second half, I opened up a window unto the emerging black middle class who are on our campuses. I can't speak about how many times I've been at a conference, and they said, there's this tremendous missionary opportunity because we used to have to go to the nations, and now the nations are on college campuses. And I want to say, yes, and so are the black people. They're there too. And I want to say to the ACNA that both of these places are mission fields. But the second of these categories, I'm not saying ignore the first one, the second of these categories are right down our alley. And a significant portion of African Americans are already making the decision to enter into evangelical spaces that are hospitable. And the question of whether or not we as a denomination are going to value it. So oftentimes I give this talk and people say, I don't have enough practical suggestions. So I'm going to give you some practical suggestions of what you can do. Because one of the things that happens with this is that people feel guilty and they're paralyzed by guilt. And I say paralyzing guilt is itself a form of privilege. Right? Deal with the reality of our historical failure. Own our legacy of failure alongside the legacy of glory. We like to tell the story about like the glories of Anglicanism. We need to own our failures and then get to work. What does work look like? First thing. We need to find out the state of play, right? How many clergy of color do we have in the ACNA? Nobody knows the answer to this question. And I tried to find this out 1,000 different times, but I have a full-time job and 4 kids, and so I can't call every diocese, right? So if I was, for example, if I'm applying for a job, if I'm applying to a university, and they want to recruit me because I'm a person of color, and I go to them, well, how many African-American faculty do you have? They may hem and haw, but they have the numbers. They would say, okay, we have 12 faculty of color. They may massage it, and, you know, what's the definition of a person of color? But you can find out. If I go to Starbucks, and I say, what's the diversity of the executive leadership of Starbucks? We know. When I ask the ACNA, no one knows. How many clergy of color do we have? Where are they? How many do we have in the process? Are they being supported, and what do they need? Another example, if I come onto a college campus and they find out African-American, PhD, St. Andrews, NT Wright, they go, just to be honest, my goodness, we struck gold. What can we do to keep this person happy? Esau, do you want a bigger office? Do you want a company car? I get all the perks. Because they know, to be honest, I'm difficult to replace. And every company does that. If they find a young person of color, they put that person with a mentor, and they guide them through the process, and they do everything to make sure that person makes it to a place of leadership. Because you know why? If that person succeeds and creates a culture, he's going to bring along all of the people with him. He's going to open up doors. He or she is going to open up doors into a community that they know that they can't reach. The question is, if the ACNA has a person of color in their diocese, are they actually treating that person as the commodity that they are? That's godly exploitation, leveraging ministry. It's true. And sometimes people say, can I take a picture of you? Like, no, you can't because I don't like your ministry. So I'm not going to let you use me to diversify y'all's organization because I don't want y'all to be diverse because I don't trust y'all. But if it's an organization that I trust, I say, that's fine. I'll do your interview. I'll do what I can. And so the ACNA needs to quit being so afraid of race. They can't recognize the fact they have people of color who they're not putting in prime positions to succeed. The vast majority of Anglican clergy who are of color are not full-time stipendiary clergy. A significant number of them have had to go into the military because they couldn't find full-time parish work. And I know you said there are no jobs in the ACNA, but there's jobs for the 20 black people who are clergy. There's those jobs. You can find them. So find out how many there are in the process. Find out where they are. Find out their pastoral care needs. Because being the only African-American person in the process in the diocese is difficult, even if they're not telling you. Okay, next. Every diocese needs to develop a plan to plant churches plant diverse churches and not just hope the diversity happens. I would like to make it a goal that every diocese plants 10 multi-ethnic churches or 5 or whatever the number is for the next 5 years. If we did that, we'd transform the province in a generation. Next, we need to revive, I know this is money. We need to revive funded curacies for our graduating clergy of color. This relates to the statement above. We need to make sure that they're placed in jobs so they can succeed. What tends to happen is if there is a black struggling church, they say we have one black clergy person, and let's put that person in the hardest possible job because it's the only black person who will do it, and they have a low likelihood of success, and then they burn out. Instead of saying, is there a place in our diocese where this person is going to thrive? We put them there, we mentor them for 2 to 3 years, and then we send them out with a multi-ethnic community to plant a church. Don't turn the clergy into heroes, but support them, because they are going to be the ones who, as priests, will raise up further clergy. Every diocese needs to develop a plan, an actual plan, to recruit and train diverse clergy. If African Americans are on college campuses and they're coming to places like Gordon-Conwell and Trinity Evangelical Seminary and Fuller, most of them come without denomination because they're all coming through InterVarsity and Navigators. So they're all broadly non-denominational who believe the Bible and are basically like, whoever believes in the Bible and will pay me, I will work for them. That's how a significant percentage of my friends became PCA when they went to Gordon-Conwell. So while we're raising up our clergy, we actually have to go to places where minority clergy are being trained and give them jobs. The House of Bishops, I feel like I've said a lot about bishops. The House of Bishops needs to develop a plan to raise up bishops of color. Hear me when I say this. That does not mean simply replacing the black bishops leading black dioceses. Once again, in any other organization, if they had a young, talented person of color, that person would be tapped for leadership and given the skills needed to develop. And the reason it's important to have people of color in the episcopate is because it changes the tenor of the conversation in the room. There are a lot of things that I read that are well-meaning, but I can just tell there was no black person who read that before it went public. It's like, I'm sorry. Send me an email. And this is the last one. We need to pray. And this may sound overly pious, but you show me your prayers and I'll show you my priority. Your priorities. I've been to a bunch of Anglican like events and churches, and they have, like, especially during the prayers of the people. And during the prayers of the people, there's often a time for extemporaneous prayer or prayers that are added to kind of the normal liturgy. And these prayers, and once again, these aren't criticisms. This is often what I hear. Let's pray for the lives of the unborn. Amen. I agree. Let's pray for our soldiers serving abroad, and let's pray for our police officers. But that means that beyond our normal prayers, the thing that's going through the minds of a person usually is like, let's save the babies and let's support our military. I never hear extemporaneous prayer of Jesus help, you know, like all of the stuff that black people pray for. I can't give you articulate that list. So you can tell that our province is being discipled to think that there are certain issues that Christians ought to consistently be praying for. Because once you get people to pray, even our leadership, what they pray about, what they think their pastor wants to hear. And so I would love to have the fact that anytime there was a Anglican extemporaneous prayer, someone said, Jesus, diversify our church. Bring the nations in. So we actually have to, and I believe that if God breaks our heart for this issue, we might fail, but at least it will be a glorious failure that glorifies God. Thank you. Okay. I think I have some water back there. Can I get that?